Chandler's trial starts next week, and the judge will probably impose a gag order. So I have to do the interview on this week's show.
I'm telling you, there is not going to be a show. There's going to be a strike. Then the network is going to start rerunning all the old FYI broadcasts, and sooner or later, they're going to get to the one where my toupee blew into a sewer grate.
I just wanted to let you know about my study group.
Oh, don't be a fuddy-duddy. I'll be your study buddy.
I'm about to embark on one of the great challenges of my scientific career.
This work right here is going to change history.
I think this is going to be our greatest mission.
I don't have time to study. I'll never get into Stanford.
I got big plans for you tonight. I got maps. I got charts. I got to see you through this because my credibility is on the line.
It's at this point that you'll want to start taking notes.
Welcome to the Sitcom Study, the podcast where we contemplate the TV shows we grew up with and search for the truth and wisdom within the tropes and cliches. And Amy, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about going on strike. We are watching Benson, Season 1, Episode 13, One Strike, You're Out. Murphy Brown, Season 3, Episode 4, Strike 2. Hanging with Mr. Cooper, Season 1, Episode 14, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Workaholics, Season 1, Episode 6, The Strike.
Going on strike, of course, this was one we hadn't thought of initially, and then when you mentioned it, I thought it was a great idea. We just had a few months ago the huge SAG-AFTRA strike, the Writers Guild thing. Yes, this has been in the headlines for ages. And yeah, it's something that happens on quite a lot of sitcoms. I'll ask this. What is your experience with organized labor, strikes, boycotts, sit-ins, etc.? Has this been a part of your life?
I've always worked on I've been a member of a union as a teacher. And then other than that, I've kind of worked on the periphery of unions and been more like a middle management kind of person that gets stuck in the middle of the labor disputes. We recently had the union at my current office was renegotiating their contract. The teachers and the support staff were renegotiating their contract with the administration. I am neither admin nor union and support staff. So it was a really tense couple of years there for me in the middle.
Yeah, this is something I don't really have to deal with as a freelancer. For better or worse, I'm sort of always subject to the whims of the market. I'm sort of always in a constant negotiation, in a sense, as someone that works on that basis. I do remember my mom, who was a teacher of sorts. She was a union leader for a while, kind of in the way I have some friends now that get roped into being like on their co-op board or the leader of their co-op board or something for a while. It's this thing that like somebody's got to do it. And it's
kind of important.
We
need you to be the treasurer.
Yeah, exactly. And so my mom occupied that role when I was a kid. It was all over my head. I didn't understand it. But I do remember a lot of the times sitting around the dinner table and just hearing like, oh, these goddamn meetings. It's what a mess. Everybody's bickering with each other. And just sort of thinking of that as one of those grown-up things that I didn't really understand. Nowadays, I think about this kind of stuff a lot in a sort of intellectual musing kind of way. You know, you and I talk about this all the time where I have these kinds of theories, not to sound like a total pinko commie weirdo, but I do think a lot about how the notion that, you know, the brain surgeon makes a certain amount of money and the janitor makes another amount of money because one job requires more education or is more highly skilled than the other. And yet we need somebody to operate on our brains and we need somebody to take out the garbage and everybody needs to eat. And so there are aspects of that whole capitalist thing of like the huge chasms and how much money people get paid and stuff like that, that are, you know, kind of baffling to me. And what often comes out of the conversations that we have is that, you know, I don't have a lot in terms of practical policy solutions to those, you know, overarching issues.
And no, you just have, you're like a normal person in the world who sees inequity and you're like, can we do something about this?
Right. And those issues are so inherent in the systems around us. Whereas strategies like boycotts, strikes, etc., are the ways in which people can use capitalism against itself.
Right.
You know, people can take that idea of supply and demand that is allowing an employer to get away with paying their workers less than is fair and saying, okay, we're still going to operate within that supply and demand concept, but we're going to exercise some power and change the dynamics within the supply and demand. So, you know, we're going to make sure you recognize the demand for us workers.
Yeah.
And the value that we provide to all that, or like a boycott on the other end saying, what if we eliminated the supply for this by not purchasing it anymore? So within that capitalist framework, you still have to respond to our demands.
Yeah.
And so, this is all very interesting to me from that point of view. I don't know that that's necessarily what's on the minds of our sitcom writers here.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, all of this kind of talking about strikes. So while I say I personally, as a grown adult, have had these sort of like next door sort of engagements with unions, the course of my own life was changed by a strike. My dad was an air traffic controller in the early 80s. The air traffic controllers are federal employees, and federal employees are not allowed to strike. So our very first episode takes place in 1979, and it's about government employees wanting to go on strike because inflation is killing them. That's what they're saying. So parallel with that storyline is the way the course of my life changed, because the postal workers went on strike, also government employees. They got what they wanted. So then the air traffic controllers said, okay, well, if the postal workers can do it, so can we. And they went out on strike. And my dad was a year one air traffic controller, so he didn't have an option. So he had to go out on strike. And the president at the time, Ronald Reagan, fired them all. This was like 1981. And I was about 2 years old. I was almost two. I was like a year and a half or whatever. And we had to move because my dad lost his job. And that's how we lived in Long Island. We lived way out on Long Island. So that's how we wound up in Florida eventually, after a series of, you know, my dad moving into a new industry. So strikes, and like what you're talking about in terms of the way that they can have an impact, not just on capitalism, not just on the economy, right? But I am a Floridian because of a strike.
Yeah, well, and you're tapping into what I think is on the minds right. of the sitcoms here. You know, I think these shows are a little bit interested in the notions of fair wages and all of that within, you know, the context of the sitcoms. But I think they're very interested in the notion of a strike as a way of shaking things up, making everything go a little topsy-turvy in one way or another, whether it's somebody having to change their job or having to bring in a new person to do somebody else's job or whatever. That's definitely going to be a thing that we're dealing with.
Exactly.
So let's start with Benson. I feel like you mentioned before, this is something that you were really into that I was not as familiar with. So tell us what the deal is with Benson.
So Benson is Robert Guillaume, and he is who you might know from Sports Night or a million and one other things. He was Rafiki, the voice of Rafiki in Lion King. He's a lauded Broadway actor as well. He was the first black man to play the Phantom of the Opera Broadway.
Yeah, he has to me, and I hope I don't come across as racist saying this, but he has this like TV version of Sidney Poitier kind of feel.
Okay.
Like that same sort of like super educated, like deep voiced, authoritative black man that's like, this is who you cast when you want to show whether it's how we've come as a society or you just really want to embrace that certain archetype. And he, like, Sidney Poitier was the big screen version, and this guy is like the TV version of that same vibe.
That's, you know, interesting. And they are kind of Broadway contemporaries, right?
Yeah.
So Robert Guillaume, he's Benson, and he is the head of the household. He's the butler. And this was Benson was a spinoff of the show Soap. Mona from Who's the Boss was the main character on Soap, and she, her butler was Benson, and then he moved over to become the butler for the governor. And the governor is a cousin, And so that's how a cousin of Mona from Who's the Boss. So they that's how they spun off this show.
And to be clear, you're saying the actress playing Mona. Soap is not itself a spinoff of Who's the Boss.
No, just no, this is all way before Who's the Boss. So she so Benson is now the butler to the governor at the governor's mansion, and he is also running the household staff. Now, throughout the length of the show, he keeps getting promoted. He eventually is like head of the finance department, which you'll see him dealing with in this episode. And then he becomes all the way up to lieutenant governor. And then the last season, he runs for governor against his boss, who's like been term limited.
Kathy Hochul of sitcoms. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. And as you can see, even this is season one Benson, right? Even in season one, he really is the, you know, the power behind the throne in terms of like getting things done, having the ideas to move the political wheels forward.
Right. This, I did not realize that he worked for a political household. I just thought he was like somebody's butler or something, like Mr. Belvedere. So yeah, he is the head of a staff of six, as far as I can tell.
Well, it's more than six, but that's who's coming in.
The personalities. Right. And yeah, they're all working for the governor. So you get a vibe. I know in the other one, it was a mayor, but he reminds me of the Barry Bostwick character in Spin City. You know, he even kind of looks like him. He's lanky and white haired like that and kind of ineffectual and bumbling. And so, yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all that Benson would ultimately become more and more empowered. Even in this one, you get the sense that he's very wise, obviously, and he brings this sort of like this kind of working man's straightforwardness, but also this sort of intellectual high-mindedness. He's got the sort of like a little bit of everything that, you know, much like these, you know, a lot of sitcom characters at this time, it's like he's the one that everybody's going to sort of like listen to.
Yeah. And that is throughout the series. He's the one, like the governor is sort of bumbling and, you know, silly and, you know, can be, I think, like you were saying, like Barry Bostwick and also Selina Meyer from Veep.
Sure.
Right. This sort of like ineffectual, bumbling politician that can be exactly spot on with their personality and charisma when they need to be. But a lot of the time, it's not so much. Well, we're in season one here. So this governor, played by James Noble, is still, I mean, he is, yes, a little bit of a space cadet, but he can get things done. He just, in this instance, he's got so many things going on that he's falling asleep literally on the job. He can't even hold a conversation because he's been up for weeks and weeks and weeks trying to solve the labor dispute with the police because the police are about to go on strike. And on the other hand, he's got the finance committee from, you know, the governor's office, and from the legislature, and the finance committee is not going to free up any more funds to give the police force a raise or any of the things that they're asking for. And now simultaneously, the household staff has decided it's been 3 years since we've had a raise. Inflation is killing us, they say, and we're trying to feed our families. And so we're not going to do it.
Yeah, you've got parallel strikes here. This reminded me, of course, of RoboCop, because that is the premise of RoboCop. The police department goes on strike, but they don't have a cybernetics program or Ed 209 at the ready here.
No.
And so, yeah, they keep explaining this dilemma of we're going to have to lay off, you know, 20% of the police in order to accomplish that. And so, yeah, the governor is in this sort of lose-lose situation. And there's this very sitcom-y scenario where Benson comes in sort of representing all the workers, you know,
right,
because the workers have been telling him, like, this is it. We're fed up. And their original plan is like, we want to go on strike right now because there's this big meeting event coming up tonight.
A dinner. Benefit 80, or whatever. 80 people are coming over for dinner. And so the household staff is going to have to get going.
Right. So, like, it will have an impact if we go on strike tonight. And so Benson approaches the governor where in the spirit of, like, you know, telling his fellow workers, don't do that yet. Let me smooth this over. Give me a chance to present all this to the governor. So they're in this sitcom-y situation where the governor is like, whatever it is, Benson, the last thing I want to hear is anything to do with increasing wages or people going on strike or fairness to workers. You know, like he's just, you know, he's already so...
He's like, happy to hear what you have to say as long as it doesn't have to do with these things. And Benson's like, I'll come back in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Does he actually bring up the strike
there? Yes, he does. He brings it up and he says, look, I've told the household staff that I would present their claims. Here's what they have, here's what they've said. And the governor's like, look, let me get through this police strike. We will, next week we'll talk about it. And, I can't get the finance committee to give any more money right now. I'm already in this big fight with them. Just let me get through. We're about to make a deal with the police officers. So we'll be able to deal with this next week. So he puts them off because at first they give Benson, they basically say, we're going to strike now. Benson says, no. And they give him, the household staff says, okay, you have until noon tomorrow to get us what we want, right? So they serve the dinner that night. And then the next morning he goes to talk to the governor and the governor says, no, sorry, I need another week. And then they stop negotiating. They're basically at the, and so now weeks have gone by and the staff walks out. That's kind of like what happens. But there's there's a jump in time.
Yeah. And this is going to be a recurring thing that they resent him for taking the teeth out of their strike. You know, They say if we had gone on strike when we originally wanted to, it would have made a difference and they would have had to take us seriously. Now that benefit, that event has come and gone. And so, sure, they don't love us not being available to them, but we don't have the same leverage,
right?
Because this event isn't happening.
And so they walk out and then Benson and the governor's daughter and the governor's secretary basically try to cover all of the jobs, like a staff. They said a staff of like 25 or something, and they're trying to do all the jobs. So the next thing we see is the household still, running-ish. It's not mayhem, but they're all very busy. Like the little daughter who's played by Missy Gold, who you might recognize that name because Tracy Gold from Growing Pains is her older sister. She's like shining the silver and helping fold the laundry, helping fold the towels and things, and they're trying to cook and feed the dogs and just do all of the things that need to get done around the governor's mansion. And then one of the household staff comes in and is like, hey, like the strike isn't going to be effective at all because you're too good. Like you're doing everyone's job. They're just going to lay us all off. Benson was like, well, the reason I was doing this in the first place is because if you walked out, you don't get to strike. It was like the FAA, government workers don't get to strike. So you're all going to get fired. He's like, I'm trying to keep things rolling so that you can strike and I can save your jobs. And he's like, yeah, but now the house is basically functioning with one or two people plus the little girl, and you're a scab.
Yeah, no, he's exactly right. He's, it's getting into the basic concept of how this works. This is what they would teach you in, your freshman high school level social studies class or whatever. In order for the strike to be effective, basically everyone needs to be on the same page. If the labor can be replaced,
things have to be missing. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
If the labor can be replaced, then yeah, you're not, all you're doing then is quitting your job or not
right.
showing up.
Right.
And yeah, but by the same token, everything in the house is sort of suffering because everybody is stretched so thin. And this is how Benson is going to cleverly weave this into a, as he puts it, a practical demonstration, this sort of metaphor. He's going to make the two strikes, the domestic strike and the municipal strike, all kind of weave together thematically, because there's going to be another event. This one's just like a little fancy dinner, right? That's happening in the house.
Right. So the two chairmen of the finance committee that the governor is trying to convince to loosen the purse strings, he's invited them over to dinner, forgetting that he doesn't, because he's so sleep deprived, forgetting that he doesn't have a staff. So they're coming over with their wives for this nice dinner at the governor's mansion. Well, there's no staff to create a nice dinner atmosphere at the governor's mansion. So Benson is doing it all, and throughout the course of the dinner is, you know, kind of explaining and showing them firsthand why they need that.
He is also going for a while. He is doing a zinger a minute.
Yeah.
Like, and again, look, from a 2024 point of view, the racial politics are maybe a little sketchy because you get the idea that this is a guy that is super classy and smart and wise and everything. But there's also this side to him, this sort of get it, your damn self kind of side that will come out once in a while.
Right. Which that was much more of his character in Soap. So they talked about like his character in Soap was super sassy. And then when it kind of, when he moved in like sarcastic and grumpy, I wouldn't even say sassy. That's not the right word. His character in Soap was more like
surly,
cynical and a little more gruff and grumpy. But then he became more like easygoing and kind of lighthearted when he became the center of his own show. And so that was just like the way the character changed a little bit. But you're seeing what you're talking about
definitely
come out in this scene for sure.
Especially the needs of this particular scenario where it's like he's stressed out and he's fed up. And so it's this dinner scene where you've got, you know, a nice classy dinner and everyone's gathered around. So he's serving the food. And, you know, every line is, it's like a couplet of somebody saying something and him immediately snapping back, you know. So at one point somebody goes like, oh, I made that soup. It's a recipe out of a magazine. He goes, Popular Mechanics. You know, just everything's like this immediate
well, and
retort.
That's the secretary, right? That's the governor's secretary. She not only helped make the meal along with the daughter, the little girl who's at the table, they all have been helping out. And so they're chiming in kind of on Benson's side to sort of explain what's going on, because she, the secretary, she doesn't cook. And we see in an earlier scene, she like burns a roast beef because she puts it on a broiler instead of in the, you know, in a roasting pan and whatever. So she's, you know, a mess in the kitchen. So that's the Popular Mechanics dig that she doesn't know how to cook. And then there's, you know, somebody asks for another glass of wine and he plops an unopened bottle down in front of him and then hands him the, you know, hands him the corkscrew. And then a little while later, another person's like, there's a piece of cork in my wine. And Benson looks over his shoulder. He goes, actually, there's two. And then he gets out a spoon and like lifts them out and throws it over his shoulder, all while telling the story of, you know, how he is the only one there. And the reason that they're stretched a little thin is this. And if you'd like dessert later, you're on your own because I've got to go clean up the kitchen and, you know, all of these things. And it like makes the finance committee, these two chairmen, realize what, like, by holding the purse strings so tight, they're actually making things worse.
Yeah, this is a very simple concept that he's demonstrating, but this is why I say that, you know, we should give the sitcom some credit that they are taking some interest in, you know, the notion behind a strike. And by having the dinner be such a mess, he's showing them like, yeah, see, being short-staffed, not having enough people due to your treatment of them results in poor quality of services. And so, yeah, it's a little silly, but that is this, as he puts it, practical demonstration. And so, yeah, later on, you know, the governor is telling him like, that was amazing. You had me fooled for a little while there, but you're a genius, you old SOB. And so, yeah, he solves everybody's problems, basically, right? By having one strike be like a metaphor for the other.
Yeah. And so the chairman of the finance committee, they decide that there is a way that they can make this work and give people reasonable raises and get them back to work. And then everybody comes back and yay, we're all happy.
Yeah. The German lady comes in and says that she would have kept striking forever. But all of the friends, she said, the ones with families caved.
They're coming back to work because they got some, not all, of what they wanted.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, they had multiple demands and they only got, you know, a smaller raise than they, you know, just like a negotiation always is,
the
right?
The usual
like
half measures.
When everybody feels like they lost something, you know the negotiation has been successful. And so everybody comes back to work with, you know, a little bit of what they wanted, losing a little, gaining a little. That's kind of how it goes.
Yeah. My only other note on this is the governor sort of like awkwardly trying to explain what Benson's like very eloquent explanation was to the other characters was right. very much the vibe of Tim Allen trying to paraphrase Wilson right. in Home Improvement. He's like, oh, what he said was you need the people for the labor or the labor needs the people. Like he just can't quite get through it.
And then he tries to tell the little anecdote about the funny thing that Benson did with all the quips and stuff and fails miserably at that. And Benson's like, it's okay, Governor, you had to be there. And he's like, but I was there. Like, not getting at all that that was like, meaning Inga, the yeah. housekeeper, needed to be there or the chef needed to be there.
Yeah. So look, for a sitcom from 1979, 1980, I actually think this one does a pretty good job of like, you know, in its own sort of Sesame Street way, like exploring the idea of a labor strike.
Yeah, I freaking love this show. This is on until like 1986 or something. This is definitely one of those shows that we watched as a family. Just always really liked this show. Found the humor very funny. And no surprise at all that this is the same producing team here that Paul Younger Witt and the somebody Thomas and Susan Harris who did Golden Girls oh. and Empty Nest mm-hmm. and Blossom and like all of these shows that like we see Paul Younger Witt on so many shows from the 80s and 90s as an executive yeah, producer.
Not necessarily on board with Empty Nest, but nonetheless.
I really liked Empty Nest when it was on. You got to watch a better episode of that.
All right. Well, we're moving on to another good one, Murphy Brown.
Season 3, Episode 4, Strike 2.
Yeah, we talked about Murphy back in our Paul Rubens episode because he was her, was he her assistant for a while?
Yes.
And then he had a whole arc rising through the company or something
Yeah, he was
like
so good at being her assistant that the CEO wanted him.
Yeah, we love Murphy Brown, very high quality show. So this one begins, the strike is already looming. This is sort of starting in media res, if you will, where they're they're at a you know morning meeting or whatever, and they're already sort of buzzing about like, oh, are we going to strike? Are we not? What's going to happen? Murphy has a story that she's excited about, and Frank is telling her, don't even bother, the strike is going to happen, and that's kind of where we are.
Right. And so we find out that Jim Dial, one of their co-anchors, is
Sam the Eagle in human form. That's what I always thought about this
right.
guy.
He's, to me, he's like Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw. Oh, like he
yeah,
is
that's
in,
what he's meant to
that's
be.
That's what
yeah.
he kind of, you know, he tries to have that sort of cachet there. So he is on the negotiating team. And so Murphy's like, no, it's going to be fine. You got Sam in there. And Miles, I really kind of felt for Miles in this situation because where Miles as the executive producer is, he's technically management, but he is not part of the team of CEOs that's right. really making all the decisions about this labor
or
issue.
Probably all the big money like that.
Right, exactly. And so he is much more on the side of his team of,
yes.
you know, newscasters who he wants to like work with to keep the show on the air and not have go on strike. And I definitely like there was a lot of I was really empathizing with Miles for parts of this episode.
He's the perpetual peacemaker. He's always just trying to avoid the confrontation, just keep everybody happy. And so he's in basically exactly the situation you described.
Yeah,
for yourself.
These horrible middle management positions. So Jim comes down and the elevator opens and immediately closes again. And as it's opening, Jim, looking all disheveled, which he never looks, just goes, strike. And then the elevator closes again. And so then they go over and they, you know, press the button and they get the door open and they're like, oh no, what's going on? And the reason this is a problem is because Murphy has scored an interview with this guy, somebody something, right? Who is the chief of the savings and loan in the middle of this savings and loan scandal.
Right.
And so he's about to go to trial. And the minute the trial starts, there's going to be a gag order on him. He's not going to be allowed to talk about it, but he's agreed to do an interview with Murphy Brown for FYI at the newscast that week. And so she's all excited. She's like, I've got to do this story. we can't be striking, and that's it. And then the CEO comes down and he's like, oh, you know, I'm on your side, guys. Like, this is just, it's just labor relations. We're going to get through it. It's going to be okay. And then he makes the mistake of saying that they're going to hire the same crappy guy that they had when Jim was out for surgery or something, that everybody hates, this anchor, yeah, this replacement anchor that everybody hates. And he's so bad. And he's so bad that they sent him off to like Kuala Lumpur to cover fake news because they just wanted to get him as far away from anything, you know, important that they were talking about as, yeah, they could.
Well, this happens because Murphy makes the mistake of telling the CEO or the owner,
right,
or whatever,
right,
about this interview, because the original plan is if they do end up going on strike, they'll just show reruns,
which
I don't,
yes,
think makes a ton of sense for a news show. I know they're like a news magazine show.
Right.
But
they're like a 2020, so,
yeah,
which definitely did show reruns,
I guess. So yeah, Frank's got this funny bit about like, oh, I know they're going to show that rerun where my toupee flew off in the wind, you know? So
yep,
that's what was going to happen. But then when Murphy tells this CEO character, I've scored this big interview, he goes like, oh great, well hey, nothing personal, but in that case we're gonna have to hire replacements, you know, we can't pass up that interview, so you're going on strike, no problem, we'll hire Miller Redfield. So he's the character you're talking about,
and sort he's of, that, like, you've seen his name's Christopher Rich, you've seen him in a ton of stuff, right?
Yeah.
He's like, he always has a little bit of twang, you know, kind of a little bit of like a Texas-y accent. I'm trying to think of the other things that I've seen. Oh, that's what we watched him in. He's the jerk ex-husband in Reba.
Yeah, that makes sense. He is the kind of guy that you cast in that role. Somebody that you want to be, quote unquote, more handsome than your main character, but less likable.
Right.
You
he's
know?
Like Ted McGinley, but even less likable.
Yeah. So this is a different take. The way Benson played out, of course, there's the threat that eventually people will be replaced, but that never happened in that show. In this case, we do have that. What we have is the strike commences. And so, you know, the FYI, the show within Murphy Brown has two anchors. It's normally Murphy and Jim. So since they're both on strike, one of them is going to be this Miller Redfield guy, this crappy pretty boy reporter, and the other one is going to be the CEO himself.
Right.
He says, I will take over the role of the other anchor.
Right. He's like, how hard can it be? I'm just reading off of a teleprompter, right?
Yeah.
So all we get of him from like then on is scenes of him with the tissues in his collar,
yeah, makeup
trying bib. To get like his makeup ready for the big show.
And it just exacerbates that thing we're talking about with Miles, where he's got to just do the Reginald Vell Johnson grin and bear it thing of like, oh, really? You're going to be the on-air talent?
Great.
Yeah, good idea. Wouldn't
Can't
have thought
wait.
Of that one. So yeah, the strike happens. So we get this whole thing taking place. We get the show starts with these two idiots anchoring it, and we have all of our characters that we know and love. They're all in their plain clothes, you know, in their civvies. We don't see the actual picket line, but we see them coming from outside to the bar that they all hang out in. And yeah, we get to see this all play out. This interview where Miles is the one ultimately that has to interview this guy, right?
Right.
This banking guy.
Yeah, this banking. So what ends up happening, right, is they, funny little side story with the bar that they always hang out, Phil's. Phil has created an executives menu because he's on the side of the workers. So when Miles and the CEO character go to eat, because they normally eat there too, they are paying, you know, $30, or I think, no, what was it, like $15 for a cheeseburger?
Yeah, he says,
which
like
made me want to cry because we pay $15 for a cheeseburger here,
yes,
now.
This was 30 years ago, but yeah. And then they say like, oh, would you like to purchase some ketchup with that?
Right, right. So that's, you know, Phil's is taking the side of the striking newscasters. And so, yeah, now it's time for the show and they're getting ready to go on. And while they're in the, you know, prepping this guy, the Miller Redfield guy, for the interview, he sits down with Miles and he's like, hey, so look, I think all this stuff about the SNL scandal, it doesn't make any sense. Like, nobody really cares about this. What the American people really want this guy to answer for is, how come when you go to the SNL building, they don't validate your parking? And how come they don't, you know, and it was something else. And it's like both very random, ridiculous things that have nothing to do with why the man is going to be on trial. And like the reason this story is a big get. That's what he's going to ask him about. So Miles is like, that's it. You know, pulls him off the air before he even gets on, says, nope, I'm doing the interview now. And now we're in the break. There's like a minute or like a 2 minute break or something between the opening of the show where the CEO guy flubs it because he doesn't realize he's on camera and he's like talking to the wrong camera multiple times. Miles goes running down to Phil's, the bar, and is like, Murphy, I'm the one doing the interview. You can't leave me out to dry. You can't hang me out to dry. You have to give me something. Just what did it say in the Senate report that you read? Because she got a sneak peek of the Senate report. Thing.
Yeah, she got this document that's like, you know, gives her even more of an edge in addition to just being a much better journalist than he is. And so this is a recurring subtrope. This is what Murphy has in common with Benson,
right,
is alienating her coworkers by helping the scab. You know, we should also mention there's a recurring joke that really falls flat to me with Corky not knowing the word scab and always saying like scar by accident.
Well, she does it. And then in the other episode, somebody else, in the Benson episode, somebody else says.
With Corky, I feel like she does it multiple times. It's just one of those things that just, it just doesn't ring true as a mistake someone would make even in a sitcom world. And now it just kind of comes across like, haha, she's stupid. Like, it's Murphy's smart so the other lady can be stupid, right? Isn't that funny? You know, like,
I mean, her character is set up in that way, and she does get progressively smarter throughout, but she is very naive and she doesn't know anything about striking. But yeah, you're right. I think the joke worked once. I don't remember it happening again, but I would agree. If they did it more than once, it definitely wouldn't have been funny. So Miles is like, just give me something. Give me one question so I can get started with this guy. And so she tells him, she's like, ask him about, you know, something in the document, why he was billing the government double and embezzling, you know, for what he was actually happening.
Expenses.
And then, yeah, billing the government double for his expenses and then embezzling the other half, right? So Miles runs back in like right as the camera is on and sits down and asks the question. And the guy goes, no comment.
Yes. Totally stumped by no comment. Miles is his Larry King-esque skills, his Woodward and Bernstein style journalism cannot handle no comment.
He's like, so you're saying no comment, but you really, are you saying you have no comment on, you know, and he asks him again and the guy's like, that's correct. No comment. And he's like, well, I think our esteemed anchor might have something to say about that. And it cuts back to the CEO, who again is in the makeup chair.
Yeah. So meanwhile, back at the bar, Murphy is getting exactly the same talking to that Benson did. Everyone is going, what the hell? Like, you can't help him. You're taking the teeth out of our strike. We don't have any leverage if you let them carry on without us. And so basically, they convince her. And so when he comes in, now, I wasn't totally clear on this. She says, okay, Miles, I'll help you again. What you have to do is just like give him the silent treatment, like just stare at him and don't say anything. Now, is the notion here, is she intentionally giving him bad advice that won't work?
So this is one of these pieces of advice, and I think it's also in another movie that's like more recent as well.
It's in 30 Rock.
Is that where it is? It's in 30 Rock? Okay, so I know I've seen it somewhere else, but this comes from Oprah and Barbara Walters. This was like, you remember those Barbara Walters specials from back in the day? That was a Barbara Walters thing. She would stare at a person, she would ask a personal question and then just like stare at a person, and then the music would play and the camera would push in slow until they started crying. And so I think that is the sort of pseudo advice Murphy is giving him, knowing that that's not going to work with this dude because it's not like a personal question that he's emotional about.
And it's probably also just a direct dig at Barbara. Maybe we know from the last episode of Murphy Brown we watched, they're not above dissing their rivals. That one ended with that weird Seinfeld takedown. Yeah, I could totally see if that's something that people associate with the Barbara Walters style interview, then yeah, part of the joke could just be like, oh, do that, and everyone hates that, you know,
right.
Like that'll be a crappy interview.
Yeah, and I, again, not up on like older people pop culture in 1990 to be able to tell you if that would have rung true in that moment. But when I heard it, I was like, oh, that is interview advice. It just isn't good interview advice for this interview.
That's why I found this story beat confusing, because watching this take place, watching her suggest that, to me, it was neither fish nor fowl. It was like, oh, that is a strategy. Because bear in mind, this is you know, take two of his question of him saying, you had these expenses, you charged your company double, you embezzled the rest, right? The guy said, no comment. So Murphy saying, what if you just stare at him? To me, that's like, that's not a horrible strategy. Stare at him with the cameras on until he says something. Like, it's not necessarily what I would suggest, but it's not like so bad that it's clear to me, the sitcom viewer, that it's meant to be sabotage.
Like, sure, but it's not going to work in a live setting. Right? This is like, FYI is a live show. It's not something that they're taping, so then you're just sitting there awkwardly waiting.
But again,
like
debatable.
A Barbara Walters special, not generally
again,
live.
Not a great idea, but to me it wasn't clear that that was such a comically bad idea that I was supposed to understand on a story level.
No, and I think the writers knew that. I think the show knew that, because then the very next thing that happens after Miles runs out of the bar the second time, right, because they cut to commercial, he runs down to the bar, he asks again for more advice, and he runs out of the bar a second time, and then Murphy's like, we're gonna have our jobs back by midnight or whatever. She tells the audience, I gave him bad advice by her
That's
reaction.
The thing. Yes, she explains it to me, the viewer, when she says that as soon as he walks out. And so I'm like, okay. And then the final button of the show, you know, while the credits are running along the bottom, is Miles and this dude sitting on the air, staring
awkwardly
at each other in silence.
Yeah.
Which again, I was like, hey, that's one way to go about it. That would get people talking. So that particular...
that would get people to change the channel.
Well, but people would go, hey, did you see the way that you know, bank CEO was speechless for 17 minutes on live TV? I don't know. Yeah, look, I think it continues that thing of... it's mostly using the strike as a, you know, pretext for hijinks and silliness and shaking things up. But it's still, you know, it's still got a little bit of a mind to that notion of like, yeah, what happens when, you know, when you don't pay people what they need and then you lose out on the talent and you have to have, you know, unqualified people taking out, you know, carrying out these tasks. Okay, we've done on air personalities, we've done police officers, now we're going to move on to teachers with Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
Season 1, Episode 14, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Yeah, this was one I definitely watched this as a kid when it came out. I feel like this was roughly contemporaneous with Drexel's Class, because I just remember this being the time when my family and I were just like, yeah, there's a new show, let's watch it, you know, like, just we're happy to, you know, to take a look at whatever you'd like to give us, you know, a family friendly show, bring it on.
Yeah, well, and so that's the thing. Well, this show, I think, what this is, 1993, this is season one, and it is in its first season not as quote unquote family friendly. At the end of this season, it kind of morphs more into the show that would later go on to be on TGIF for several years, and it had different cast members. Like, I completely forgot that Dawn Lewis, is that her name, who plays his roommate that's not Holly Robinson Pete. Well, she wasn't Holly Robinson Pete yet. She was just Holly Robinson at the time. But I forgot she's from a different world, and then she left A Different World to come be on this show and only ended up in this show for one season as well, because when they added Raven Simone in the second season and Nell Carter in the second season, and the show kind of took that more like family friendly bent. And then within, I think by season three, it was on TGIF.
Yeah, I think I probably watched the early ones. Just hearing you describe the direction it took and thinking about the timeline, 93 would be about the time I would be watching something like this. A couple years later, I'm well into high school. I'm, you know, listening to Kurt Cobain. I think I probably had stopped, you know, I probably wasn't paying attention to it anymore because I very much remember the Holly Robinson and this other woman, this setup and this general vibe.
Yeah. Well, Holly Robinson doesn't leave. Right. She stays on throughout, becomes his fiance and girlfriend later on. That's what I remember. I was like, wait a minute. I thought they were dating. Like, why are they arguing so much in this episode?
And I remember them more as roommates like this. So what's the premise of this? This is another stand-up comic who's given a TV show, right? Is that who Mark Curry is?
So this show set in Oakland, which is his, you know, Mark Curry's actually, you know, his hometown. And it is created by the same people that created Full House. And these were originally at the same time, like before Full House moved to TGIF, these were back-to-back shows. So like Full House was the lead-in for this show. And then Full House moved, and then later on Hanging with Mr. Cooper moved as well. But so this show kind of, you know, that show set San Francisco, this show set in Oakland, that was like their little world there. And the very first episode of Hanging with Mr. Cooper was filmed on the Growing Pains set. And Mr. Cooper meets Alan Thicke, and there's like a little crossover going on there. So kind of funny little side note. But so in this episode, the teachers, so Mark's character, Mr. Cooper's, is a substitute teacher and gym coach, and he's trying to like be a full-time teacher and not just a substitute teacher at the school. Well, his roommate and best friend since childhood, who's played by Dawn Lewis, I think her name's Robin in the show, she is leading the teachers union and is like the president of the strike council or whatever. And so she's having a meeting at their house, and Mark is kind of like crashing the meeting. And she's like, you're not even on the strike council. Get out of here, you know, whatever. So they decide to go on strike, which means he's out of a job too. And so then Holly Robinson's character, Vanessa, says, well, why don't, you know, if you're strapped for cash, why don't you come take a temp job in the mailroom at my office? And she works at some like hoity-toity, you know, accounting firm or something like that. And so he says, all right. And that's the premise of this episode. So they're out on strike. He gets a new job.
Yeah. Now, is he a teacher just because, like, for normal reasons, like his athletics career dried up and he decided to have a new job? Or is there a wacky, you know, sitcom-y backstory?
The sitcom-y backstory is just that he's a former NBA player because the man himself is very tall. That works. And he played for the Golden State Warriors, which is right there where they are. And he, you know, career was over. And so now he's trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life. But he was not a super famous player that could like parlay that into, you know, like an ESPN deal or something else. He was just kind of, you know, a guy who sort of rode the bench, played a little bit, you know, whatever, and now he's done. So what's he going to do? And he's trying to figure his life out.
Yeah, and the show, this episode, will get into his particular level of fame where he's noticeable to certain people but is not worshipped like other people are. Yeah, so we're going to have, like we said before, the strike is going to be the stimulus for a shakeup. And in this case, it's going to be straight up, I have to get a new job. Now, this show is sitcom-y as hell. That is my initial take.
En Vogue is singing their opening sequence.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, and is starring in the opening sequence.
Yeah. So my note when the show started was, I definitely remembered the "Yo Coop, you're on," the thing that they yell at the start of the theme song. And then I wrote down how specifically locked in time I was, like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, be so such, I'm gonna show how culturally savvy I am to point out that this theme song is done in exactly the style of En Vogue, and that's amazing. invents it in this particular moment in pop culture. And then in the end, I see theme song by En Vogue. Oh, okay, that makes sense.
That was one of my first CDs. I got a CD player when I was in sixth or seventh grade, and my first CDs were the 90210 television soundtrack and En Vogue.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, yeah, super of its time. And then his whole persona in the show, I definitely got a, like, Fresh Prince vibe, that yes. sort of bull in the china shop, like, I'm just going to be a cad, I'm just going to, you know, any place that's, like, a sort of stuffy or toned down situation, I'm just going to bust in and be really silly and stuff. And so, yeah, definitely that same feel. But what made it so sitcom-y to me is just the jokes are just very sitcom 101. You know, this story beat where he takes the job with Holly Robinson, you know, it's got the thing of the scene ending with him going, you're never going to see me as some kind of receptionist, hard cut to, you know, the next day, Holly Robinson's workplace, and he comes in with the little mail cart or whatever. That thing
in a bow tie.
Yeah. They call it like the horse cut or something, because it's like the guy says, you'll never see me on a horse, and then you cut to him riding a horse. It's just, right. And look, it's funny sometimes, like good movies still do it, but it's just very sitcom-y. And there's going to be a number of times throughout this episode that I'm just like, oh, this is very kind of basic in that way.
Yeah. Well, some of my favorite moments in the show are when, Mr. Cooper, not only is he a basketball coach and like, you know, substitute teacher, but he is the basketball coach there at that school.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of the kids, his players, come over and like just stop by the house and, you know, hang with Mr. Cooper. And so, and one of the players, he looks so familiar. And I'm like, gosh, I can't figure out who that is. And the credits come up and it's Omar Gooding. And I was like, oh, that's right. That's Cuba Gooding Jr.'s older brother.
Oh, wow.
And I remember when the Jerry Maguire came out, I was like, I had the same notion. I was like, why does this Jerry Maguire guy look so familiar? And then I was like, oh, his brother wasn't hanging with Mr. Cooper. It was like this weird thing that happened to me like 25 years apart with the Gooding brothers.
Yeah, this is going to be very much in the tradition of Drexel's class and head of the class, the teacher hanging out with the students, you know, in their personal time, which right. never happens in real life, but happens on sitcoms all the time.
I mean, it does happen in real life, and then the police are involved.
Yes, it is not in the same context of like, this is just a typical, you know, Saturday afternoon in your living room. So what happens here is, like we were saying, because of Mr. Cooper's basketball fame, some of the higher-ups, the muckety-mucks at this company, whatever firm it is that Holly Robinson works for, recognize him and kind of go like, oh, hey, come hang out with us. And basically, you know, within a day, a week, whatever it is, he's got, you know, a nice salary. He's got a secretary who is Holly Robinson. Like, yes. She has been made his secretary.
Yes. Well, so the guy that we see in the initial scene that's like the owner of the company, it's Toplin and Toplin, right? So you would think that the two men that we're seeing that are supposedly these executives are Toplin and Toplin, but turns out one is Toplin and the other is some guy that has a modicum of fame that we just don't know who he is, that gets kicked to the curb the minute Mr. Cooper comes in, and Toplin, the number one, recognizes him and he makes the sale, because this other guy, who this client that they're trying to sell, Mr. Cooper's able to make the sale to this guy because the guy recognizes him from the Golden State Warriors, right? So then we fast forward to maybe a month or so later, a few weeks later, the teachers have been out on strike still all this time. They're trying to solve the strike. Don is like, look, our teachers are going out and getting other jobs. And then Mr. Cooper comes in and he's like, hey, have a little money here, have a little money there, have a little money there. And so this administrator guy who's like on the negotiating team is talking to Robin, and he's like, is this true? Are teachers getting jobs like this? And she's like, yeah. And they're never going to come back to be teachers because look at how much money they're making. You need to go. And he's like, all right, message received. I'll go pass it along. And off he goes. And so then the next day or something, then Mr. Cooper goes back to work. at his new, you know, fancy job. And Holly Robinson has had enough of being his secretary because she got moved, not moved, but she was on the desk of the other guy that he replaced that got kicked to the curb when he came in.
Yeah.
And then Marcus Allen walks in. Heisman Trophy award winner Marcus Allen.
He comes in and takes over Mark's job. This is the same trope as like, when you ditch your friends to hang out with the cool kids,
right.
You know, it's like the same thing of like, oh, if you roll the dice on these people that don't really have any character because of these sort of like superficial things that they could offer you, you know, it's like, ah, you're just today's, you know, soup of the day, buddy. And,
exactly.
You know, the flavor of the week.
That's right.
And yeah, if you don't, you know, if you don't hang out with the people who like you for you, then it's not going to last. And so, yeah, he gets fired. The real Marcus Allen, we get, you know, in the tradition of Don Drysdale from our Donna Reed episode, we get another athlete playing himself. Much like Don Drysdale, I don't know who this is, but again, because of the acting skill, I could tell it's a real athlete playing himself.
Or lack thereof, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so then, you know, he gets replaced basically as quickly as he gets comfortable. And he's like, oh, well, I guess I'll have to go, you know, back to being a teacher, but that's okay. And then you've got this fun little, like, B story with the kid who is the son of their landlord always coming around to collect the rent. And he's this sort of salty, sarcastic little kid who makes, you know, gives Mark a hard time, Mr. Cooper a hard time all the time. And we get a great joke at the end where the kid's running away from him and he's yelling at him, it's going to be Home Alone 2, Lost in Oakland. Get back here with my money.
Yeah. This Mr. Cooper character is a little bit of a creep, I will say. He's a sort of like 90s style cad, but you know, you were talking about how the show got more family friendly in the later seasons.
Yes.
There's this moment towards the end of this where he's sitting there with Holly Robinson and they're talking about their friendship, and she's saying like, yeah, I'm you know, I'm so glad we're friends or something like that. And he goes like, yeah, he says, maybe there's something that we can do to make our friendship even stronger.
Yes.
And she goes, what's that? And he just stares at her and starts unbuttoning his shirt.
Yes.
And like, again, like, I don't want to be waving my finger and clutching my pearls like Mr. Rogers. Oh, you know,
no.
Like such a prude. But it is just like, oh, so that's the joke. Like,
yeah.
The joke, well, just is, I want to fuck you.
But it's awkward, right? Like, that whole moment was awkward. And it's interesting that they do end up dating and engaged later on in the series, because this is season one. This is him, like, establishing that he's into her. But they're on ABC. They're not on Fox. So they're, like, trying to do a Fox thing, but
yeah.
Can't really go all the way because ABC. So it was just really interesting to kind of watch that sort of awkwardness play out. And then, you know, I would like to see a few episodes in the interim between now and when they actually start dating in like season three or season four or something, to kind of see how that develops into a more natural banter and chemistry between the two actors. Because what isn't present and why that joke isn't funny is because they don't have chemistry.
That's part of it. Another part, I would argue, is that it's not a joke. Like, that is the thing. Saying, you know, what's that? What can we do to strengthen our friendship? And then having him unbutton his shirt, like, that's the beginnings of a joke. Like, there's something there. But yeah, I just, to me, not ready for prime time, as they used to say.
it's like a Louis C.K. version of a joke.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to be really passive over here.
I will say, Holly Robinson loomed large to me as a kid.
Oh,
huge,
gorgeous.
Crush.
Yes.
Yes. We'll never talk about it properly because it's not a sitcom, but 21 Jump Street.
Yes.
What a show. Just the idea that they recognized that they were always casting adults in the roles of teenagers on TV and movies and decided to make that the premise of the show.
Yep.
To go, oh, okay. So what if you had 28-year-old Johnny Depp pretend to be a high school sophomore in order to bust a weed dealer? Like, I guess we can do
this
that.
This can work. That's same boat, no, man.
Hot as hell,
loved,
one and all.
That's right. I loved that show. It's like Johnny Depp is such a disappointment to me because he had so much potential as a heartthrob. Like, you could have grown old like Paul Newman, but instead you're Johnny
Depp.
And
he's still, I mean, look, in my opinion, he gave the world decades of amazing stuff. He just turned into a monster in the last few years. But yeah, and also just a quick, like, style corner. She is wearing the whole time, like, this suit that is, like, only a blazer.
No, that's at the second suit she wears. She wears, like, three suits in the episode. But yeah, she has got some, like, I mean, she's model skinny. Like, she's gorgeous, right? So she has her suit, that last suit that she wears that's a blazer, but it's a dress, is tailored within an inch of its life. In the back, they have a shot of her from the back where she's handing her resignation to Mr. Cooper because she doesn't want to be his assistant anymore. And it has in the back the darts where you, like, you know, sew things together so that it'll fit people just right. It's double-breasted in the front, and she has no less than six darts in the back, like, that are perfectly tailoring this blazer suit to her body. Like, she is suffering from none of the over-shoulder padded, oversized,
boxy
90s apparel.
It uses her distinctive figure to make her, like, into this, like, sort of cartoon character, but not in a bad way, but it's just like, yeah, it just makes her like a pencil. Like, she's just one thing.
Like, I loved that dress. I was like, ooh, I think I could wear that now.
She looks great. And I guess just last thing, tracking the trope-wise, this one is sort of the least interested in, like, the philosophy of the strike, right? I think this is the most of, like, this is going to be the impetus for a story where Mark and Vanessa have to work together.
Yes.
And, you know, we get the teachers meeting stuff, but...
And what ends up happening is the teachers don't get anything. They just didn't get... So they were going out on strike because cuts were looming. They were going to give everybody an extra class. They were going to, you know, take away a vacation day or something. They were going to do some cuts. And so the teachers were like, absolutely not. So then at the end, it was like, oh, well, what did you get us? You know, what, you're the Robin, you're the head of the strike committee or whatever. What did you get us? And she's like, nothing. We just didn't have all the cuts. Like, so what they ended up agreeing to was
status quo. Yeah. Well, but it makes sense if those things were going to happen.
Right.
But yeah, like I said, not really the focus of the episode. Moving on to Workaholics.
Season 1, Episode 6, The Strike.
Yeah, so now we're well into the 21st century. This is another one I think of kind of like Strangers with Candy, you know, a sort of in the world where, you know, a half hour comedy can kind of be anything, you know, these newer shows that are just, you know, a little crazier and sort of untethered from reality in their different ways.
Yeah, this show I would often, because I didn't watch this show. I know of all of these characters, right? Like, you've got, what's his name? Anders Holm. He goes, well, I guess, by Durs, which is kind of funny to me. He was one of the boyfriends on the Mindy Project. He's the minister guy that's like a super cool rapping minister. And then you've got Adam Devine, who is from the Pitch Perfect movies and a bunch of other stuff, you know, very funny. And then the other guy with the long hair, who I don't know very well from a lot of things. But this show, in my mind, just because of what it's called, Workaholics, I always got confused with the British show, The IT Crowd. It's three people. They've got, you know, one of them's their boss. Well, it's three people, two guys and a girl, and one of them's the boss. That was Chris O'Dowd. And, oh man, I always forget Moss's real name. And so that's the IT Crowd. And yeah, for some reason, just I get these shows confused and I can never remember the name, The IT Crowd. I always think that show is called Workaholics, and it's much better than this show. But that's for another time. This show, Comedy Central, fun, kind of, you know, silly, irreverent, ridiculous, a little bit like, It's Always Sunny, but without like as good, like without the quality.
Yeah, that is a very high bar, I think. It's Always Sunny is one of the best examples of the kind of show that we're talking about. Yeah, the examples that I was going to were things like the Sarah Silverman program, Broad City, this new generation of shows that I think is partially, it's coming up in the age where now YouTube and the internet exists.
Right.
And so I think that's part of it.
Well, and that's how they got this show. They had a bunch of YouTube stuff on YouTube from their comedy sketch troupe group.
Yeah, and that's also the origin story for Broad City and a lot of other new things. But this idea of like, in the older shows, like you think of, we would talk about these characters like Joey in Friends or Joey in Blossom, where they're so stupid that it's like kind of cartoony and sometimes to different extents, like people butt up against that because they're like, oh, they're so dumb that you just can't believe it.
Like you and, just did with Faith Ford is Kirky Sherwood.
And these newer shows now are like, no, we're just going to have like the whole world is going to be like so sort of heightened and weird that you have characters like the Broad City gals or like the Sarah Silverman version of herself that she plays, or definitely like the It's Always Sunny characters where either intellectually or morally, like they are just complete blanks,
right?
Sometimes, like they, in the case of this show, they have not heard of a strike. They don't even know what that means. Or, you know, somebody might not understand why, whatever it is, like the most simple moral or intellectual concept will be like totally unfamiliar to them. But unlike Friends or Blossom, it's not even trying to take place in the real world. It's
right.
taking
no,
place.
No, it's like they grew up as feral children and now they're grown.
Yeah. And the whole pitch of the show is just so odd that you just buy into it and you don't wonder like, ah, nobody's that dumb or nobody's that evil or selfish or whatever it is. And this very much has that vibe of the three of them are just on their own planet. And it's just like this funny little Twilight Zone world that they live in. Now, we should say this occupation, we've done now police, domestic workers, and teachers. Now we're going to have telemarketers.
That's right. So the premise of this show is these three friends. So you've got Blake, you've got Adam, and you've got Anders. And there's this whole story that everybody calls him Anders. And he's like, I got a hard on at the beginning of my name, a hard on. And so they are telemarketers. They know each other from college. And Anders was the RA. And Blake and Adam were roommates. And that's how they came to be this. They call themselves the friendship family. They live together in a house in Rancho Cucamonga in California, and they work at this telemarketing service. And that is their life, and they have all sorts of, you know, crazy adventures. That's the setup of the show. So in this show, they have an annual tradition of celebrating half Christmas, because one time Blake went to the store to get a keg, and he accidentally brought back a keg of eggnog, which they called Kegnog. And they drank from it, you know, the milky juiciness, and decided to celebrate a holiday. And that's what they have decided to do, or that's what they've done for years now. So now they're trying to bring that to their office, and they decorate their whole cubicle, because the three of them share a big cubicle. They decorate their whole cubicle with Christmas decorations, and they go and they ask their boss, who is this like evil hose beast. Yeah. Like, she's always mean. She never has a nice thing to say.
She's kind of like Schmidt's boss in New Girl.
Yes, she's just very insulting at all times. And they go and ask her for a day off so that they can celebrate half Christmas.
Yeah, they want 2 days off.
Oh, that's
They're
right.
like, we've never asked for anything, and we don't mind that because we love telemarketing so much. It's just part of their weirdness. But they're like, we do want 2 days off for our half Christmas thing. And says no.
She's like, get the fuck out of here. And so then they decorate their cubicle, and then she tells them they have to tear it all down because it's distracting people. And so then they go to the store to
supermarket.
Like, first they go to the store to get all the decorations, and they see that the people are striking, and they find out what a strike is.
Right. Yeah.
And so then when they get told they can't have the 2 days off, everyone but Anders goes back. Blake and Adam go back. Anders tells us from the beginning when he sees the people striking, he's like, nope, that's what happened to my family. We had to quit the country club when my dad's, the factory that my dad owned, the workers went on strike, and that made my family fall into hard times. And so we had to quit the country club.
He's like you. The course of his life was changed by a strike.
But the result of that is that he thinks all strikes are bad and they ruin people's lives. So he's like, no, I won't support your strike, supermarket workers, and I won't support my friends, Blake and Adam, who are about to go out on strike. So Blake and Adam go back and they find out how to strike from the striking workers. And they say, that's it. We're going on strike. And they get a barbecue grill and they try to barbecue a turkey.
Yeah, they're like tailgating basically their own office. Yeah, this is where I really get that Sarah Silverman vibe. Just that childlike quality where they're just like, they've never heard of a strike, you know, and this is all news to them as they're explaining, you know.
Right. They're like, wait, you can just not work? And this is what Corky Sherwood says too. She's right, like, you can not work and still get paid?
Yeah. Yeah. She thought it was a paid vacation, which again, part of her stupidity.
Right.
But so they're having a barbecue in the parking lot. One of them gets a cowboy hat from the garbage. So again, just that vibe, the silliness, that early 2000s, you know, I didn't catch it. You mentioned that friendship family thing. Like, that phrase to me just totally taps into that sort of like Seth Rogen type sense of humor from this time where it's like, we're finally done with the homophobia. So now straight young men in comedies are gonna just have so much fun, just like saying how much they love each other and just being so touchy-feely because there's something funny about that in this new world we live
in. Yeah, we're in the time when Verizon had their Framily plan.
Yeah. So, just that weird sort of cutesy sense of humor. We're the friendship family, that weirdly sort of ironic, like, it's funny, but you can't really explain why.
So the office hires two people to replace them.
So this is Clint Howard and Rance Howard. So these are two very distinctive, recognizable character actors, especially Clint Howard. Clint Howard is Ron Howard's brother, and Rance Howard is their dad.
So those are the scabs that are hired, but not even scabs, because the boss is like, yeah, those guys quit. They're not on strike. It's just the two of them sitting outside drinking. Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah.
Again, I mean, this is the same thing as with all of these stories. It blurs the line, right. You know, going on strike is essentially quitting or not doing your job or whatever. And yeah, we get very much the same situation as with Murphy Brown. These two chuckleheads are like Redfield Miller or whatever that guy's name was. They, you know, they're the dummies that you bring in to replace the other people.
Right. And so, you know, Anders is struggling because he's got these two cubicle mates who don't even know how to use computers.
Well,
and
one of them does.
One of them is like a total pedophile.
Yeah, Clint Howard. Yeah, it's very funny. When he first shows up, like the first thing he says is like, what's the policy on, you know, like cybersecurity or whatever? And then as soon as he sits down to the computer, he goes, Craigslist casual encounters is blocked. What is this, North Korea?
Yeah. So there's, you know, he's so uncomfortable, but his boss is like, don't you worry, you're on the fast track. You know, I see what's going on. And so she gives him a Bluetooth headset,
yes,
which is like an upgrade for his telemarketer.
We should also wired lay the headset. Seed. This boss lady who's, you know, flattering him and giving him all this stuff will not recognize his hard on. She keeps calling him Anders.
Well, that's the thing that breaks it. Like, she doesn't say his name until this
okay.
one
I guess
moment.
It's other people saying it because he has to constantly remind
mates.
People.
Yes, it's his cubicle mates who are doing it, and he's getting more and more annoyed by them. And then he gets moved out of that cubicle and becomes like the assistant when Blake and Adam go back again to the supermarket and ask the striking workers there, like, what are we doing wrong?
How does this work? Because they don't understand the concept of a union, let alone a union leader or anything like that.
And they're like, we're pretty sure that we've just been replaced and we've just been fired, because Anders tells them that. And so they go back and they ask, and the workers, the striking workers at the supermarket are like, well, have you talked to your union boss? And they're like, what's that? And so they're like, we have to get other employees to go out with you. That's the only way a strike will work. So they start meeting other employees in the parking lot, asking what they want as their demands. Yeah. And everybody has random different, like, I want a milkshake machine, and I want, you know, my dead daughter to come back. Yeah. And I want
this. But some of them are real. That's part of the joke, is like interspersed with these silly ones are like, I want health insurance.
Yeah, I want health insurance and 2 extra days of vacation. Yeah. Right?
Well, that was their original thing for their Festivus or whatever.
Their half Christmas. Exactly. So now they've got the whole office, except for these two Howards and Anders, are all out in the parking lot. And it's like a strike party. They're just having a good old time. They're not carrying signs, really. They've got maybe a few, but mostly they're just hanging out, having barbecues, and drinking eggnog out of a keg.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Now, where this story goes is very, you know, 2011 or whenever this came come out, because it all starts to revolve around the do not call list.
That's right.
So if you're a telemarketer, I guess this must have been a big deal when this happened. So I guess the scandal, this sort of John Grisham-esque plot here, is that this company is using the do not call list as like the call list.
As their numbers, like,
they're taking numbers directly off of them and using them as leads and having their telemarketers call. And so when this boss lady is like, oh, hey, Anders, you're going to get this fancy new job. And hey, tell you what, you know, I'll help you learn the ropes by letting you listen in on my conversation, my phone call with the big boss, you know, whoever that is. And that's when this sort of comes out, you know,
he gets tipped off. Like, he gets tipped off that it's happening. And then she comes out to him and she was like, you see, Anders, this is how you do it. You're moving to the top, Anders. And she says it twice. And we have this like close up shot on his face, like the dissonance of being like, I want to succeed in my job, but she's doing the thing that drives me crazy.
So now she's making an enemy at exactly the time that she's giving him the knowledge to take her down. So we have like a good old fashioned negotiation, right? We have like a boardroom with 20 or 30 people. All, you know, it's like the whole workforce of this
all
call center
standing on one side of the table, and then the long table empty, and at the other side is the boss and Anders standing beside
her. Boss lady, Anders, and the two wacky replacement guys.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Clint Howard and Rance Howard. And and then so you have Adam and Blake are like speaking for everybody. The climax is Anders changing sides, right?
Well, so they say all their demands, like the, you know, Adam Devine is reading the list of demands, the wacky ones, the real ones. She's saying, I'm not giving you any of that. You all are ridiculous. Like, we don't need you anyway. It's, you know, get out of here. You're so replaceable. And he was like, well, maybe this will change your mind, and slides the do not call list across the long table. And then Anders walks along the side of the table and turns around and stands with them. And he says, I just so happen to really like a milkshake machine. Right. And so like, that's why he decided to turn coat and join the other side of the strike, even though he doesn't believe in strikes at all. So she's like, I was only using it to keep my job. My bosses said we had to use the do not call list, but fine. I'm not going to get my head's not going on the chopping block for you assholes. You can have a half day for your stupid half Christmas celebration. And they're like, and what about, you know, a milkshake machine or something like that? And she was like, you know, said yes to some other silly thing. And this one lady's like, but what about health insurance? My husband has lupus.
Yeah. And they're like, don't ruin it for everybody, Beverly.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, just that sort of like, oh, they can be immoral in these kind of shows. And it's funny because the whole show is just so silly.
Ridiculous.
And I liked this. You know, we talked last time with Strangers with Candy about how, you know, those kinds of shows are funny, but just by their nature, they're sort of like deconstructing what a sitcom even is, and they're not going for any real like stakes or characters. They're yeah. just trying to mess around and be silly and sort of give you their own style of craziness, which can make them kind of hard to get into. But I kind of jived with this a lot more too. Than Strangers with Candy.
Yeah. And I think like when we were talking about doing Workaholics and we were going back and forth between Workaholics and Big Time Rush,
yeah.
which is another one that it's that a Nickelodeon. A yeah. has a yeah. strike episode. They, it's a Nickelodeon show. It came on after iCarly or like in the same kind of block as iCarly. And that's the only reason I know it. Because, you know, also from, you know, 2011. And so we were looking for that more recent one. And it was between those two. And I was like, oh, man, I don't really know. I don't remember Workaholics that much because I didn't really watch it. But I know those guys are funny, like the two out of the three guys I've seen in these other things. I wonder if it'll be kind of like Silicon Valley-y. And I just don't remember. And I just don't remember. Or it'll, you know, I do always get like Workaholics confused with the IT Crowd. And so, you know, oh, I don't really remember. I'm kind of interested. And I'm glad we went this way because yeah. I did like it. I was worried too that it was going to be a little like Strangers with Candy, but that you're seeing the difference between, I think the Strangers with Candy was like 2003, 2005.
Yeah.
And this is 2011. And there was a Definitely. Change in the humor. We are now solidly out of that like mean 1990s, you know, I'm edgy humor.
Yeah, there's that. And also just the production value of it, like these shows, these sort of like random cable shows that don't have as much money behind them just look so much nicer in 2011 yeah. than they did in 2003. But yeah, I like this. Again, like I think these guys would get on my nerves after a while. I'm not going to binge watch, you no. know, two seasons of Workaholics. But yeah, it was fun. So yeah, looking back on these, this was a pretty fun lineup, you know, in the yeah. sense that they all, it's a trope that revolves around workplaces, and we got all of these different workplaces, but we got to see the way they all, you know, it's like a fun Venn diagram where it's like these two or three overlap in that way, but are different than that one. And these ones overlap this way and are different from that one. I don't know. What do you think in terms of, do you have a favorite? Is there an MVP?
Oh man, I don't know. I could like just on pure like watchability and talent and all of that stuff, I don't have a number one, but on pure nostalgia, Benson, Benson first appearance on our podcast. I haven't watched Benson since I was a child. I remember that show fondly. I remember thinking it was very funny and watching it again, just now being grown up and watching so many sitcoms because we do this, the quick jokes and that repartee, it reminded me of Golden Girls, the way there's always a one-liner. Somebody's always got a cutting remark, but not a cutting remark in the way that it's like makes me sad. It's more like silly and fun and full of friendship and laughter. And I really enjoyed that. And I'm going to put that on a list of nostalgia picks for our TGIF lineup that we do just for us, for sure. And you can never go wrong with Murphy Brown, but I don't think this was a great episode of Murphy Brown.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It was fine. There was nothing bad about it. But I think that's a show that, like we say with some other shows, it works best when it's kind of business as usual, I think, right. when it shakes things up too much and gets them out of their element, especially if we're only going to watch it once in a while. It's like, no, I want to see the ones where she's doing the news and yeah. she's doing that stuff. I am on the same page that watchability wise, they're all like, it's kind of a wash and yeah, like they were all pretty,
but like
fun.
A positive wash.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, definitely. I feel like in terms of using the trope, the thought that just kind of came to me was like, if I had to use one of these to show to like a middle school kid to help explain what a strike is,
oh,
it would
Benson.
Be Benson.
Yeah.
Because yeah, like we said before, that's the one that really digs into it, like using these multiple strikes to show like, yeah, this could happen within a home or on a larger level. on a city and to sort of show on that micro and macro level, here's why it breaks down when you don't recognize the value of the people working and everything. And then, yeah, his, you know, comedy stylings when he starts getting overwhelmed and starts getting fresh with everybody, like that was pretty good. So yeah, I guess at the end of the day, that's kind of the one that I liked the best, which is a shock to me just because when that started with that theme sequence, I feel like, again, that's one of those theme sequence is what that Too Many Cooks things. Like, it's one of those that it's playing off of. So 80s, so beige, and just, you know, the dopey music and everybody smiling at
everybody
the camera.
Like turning towards the camera and smiling in the middle of some other activity.
Yeah. The final word I want to say about that, because I didn't get to it when we were talking about the show properly. Benson's cardigan game is strong. He wears no less than 3 different cardigans throughout the course of the show. I don't think he ever is seen not in a cardigan.
Well, he's in a white suit coat when he is serving dinner. Okay,
fair enough. But it's like different colors to reflect the different situations, and just really good. Like, for a show made in, you know, 1979, like, I would happily take on this wardrobe today.
You always say that about the shows made in the 70s, though. You love the sweat hogs.
Yeah, I guess I do. So yeah, look, I mean, what can we say? You know, The Strike, if it's a show about a workplace, and in one way or another, these all are, that's what it's going to get you. Like, it'll shake things up, right? Whether or not it gets you thinking about the nature of, like, labor and fair practices and stuff.
No, but it might make you think about your own personal situation.
Yeah, and it will definitely get you, again, like, weird replacement workers and somebody having to do a different job and stuff like that. You know, all the stuff that sitcoms thrive on.
That's right.
All right, so much for The Strikes. What are we talking about next week?
Next week, it's our season one finale, so we're watching some season one finales. MASH, season one, episode 24, Showtime. Living Single, season one, episode 27, What's Next? How I Met Your Mother, season one, episode 22, Come On! And Brooklyn Nine-Nine, season one, episode 22, Charges and Specs.
Yep, we're going to be celebrating one full year of the podcast next week. And until then, we will consider this segment of the sitcom study concluded. Thank you for listening to the Sitcom Study. Tell us what you think or share your own TV tropes and topic ideas by sending a self-addressed stamped email to sitcomstudypodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook or Instagram. And if you like the show, consider leaving a rating or review on your podcast app. It helps us boost those precious Nielsen ratings. The Sitcom Study is recorded in front of a live studio dog.